My topic tonight is the suffering of ill will. This topic illustrates what Stephen Batchelor meant when he said that we are all living with the devil. And there are a lot of people, I think, who feel that this devil is their ally. I once counseled a woman who took refuge in it. She found it comforting to be angry. For a lot of people, blame is a game of hiding in ill will to avoid the original suffering caused by the abuses of life. And this was that woman's story. She really believed that it was her friend, and it would protect her from the kind of injury she had already suffered. And so it can be seductive, like heroin. It can kill the pain in the moment, but its hook is really damaging. And we inherit some ill will from our culture, just living in society. I grew up in a time when the society was filled with forms of group hatred. We referred to them as the isms, racism and anti-Semitism and many forms of ill will that were just institutionalized, just built into normal discourse. And I think this may be the great work of the baby boomer generation to reveal and reduce this kind of systemic hatred. Nonetheless, it lingers. It's still there. We seldom decide to have ill will. Probably Adolf didn't get up in the morning and think, I'm going to hate me some people today. It's like a demon. It sneaks up and takes over subtly. It has its rationalizations. The suttas talk a lot about being totally without ill will. Now, I've had moments, maybe even hours, but then I drive somewhere and someone inevitably annoys me. And there are people whose company I do not actively seek out, but they pop up in my life and I'm grumpy again. The hardest of all, though, are the ones that I love, because they're always right there and they incur my wrath in countless ways. Not following my plan is a big way. Partly because my loved ones are usually a part of my plans, which goes to show that expectations are dukkha in training. And ill will is a form of dukkha that spreads like a disease. It can prompt us to be unkind to the target of our ill will. And then that person is grumpy and passes it on to others. And then we regret what we've done or said. And that makes us grumpy too. And we just keep spreading the dukkha around like a virus. In the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a sutta, number 7.64, that says, the one who practices for his own benefit, but not that of others, is to be criticized for that reason. the one who practices for both his own benefit and that of others, for that reason, is to be praised. Okay, now praise and criticism are two of what's called the eight worldly winds, over which we have pretty much no control. So we might better reduce our dukkha around ill will by focusing on how miserable it makes us, and also how we pass it on to others. This is a big piece of the Dharma, a big piece. It is taught that the first noble truth is to be fully understood, that dukkha is a part of life, and to see how it arises and what the experience of it is really like. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, "In the course of our daily life, we can learn to restrain the coarser manifestations of the root causes of dukkha by keen self-observation, and can gradually loosen these root causes of suffering and their grip upon us." And in my experience with this process, every little bit helps tremendously. So, to follow Bhikkhu Bodhi's advice, let's take an experiential look at the suffering of ill will. So I invite you to relax. You might just leave your note taking things in your hands, but relax and close your eyes and watch yourself take three breaths. Think of someone you have a grudge against. Think of why you feel that way about them. And when you feel your body tighten or otherwise respond to these thoughts, shift your attention to that physical feeling. Hold your attention there on the physical feeling. Now breathe compassion for yourself into the area of your body that's feeling ill will. Watch the feeling, any changes it goes through. Keep breathing. If the feeling begins to fade, you might want to hold that compassion for yourself like a protective cloud around you and expand it outward to include other beings. Expanding more and more as you think of them until you're sharing compassion for yourself with all beings, including the person you have a grudge against. There needs to be no need, no reason for that compassion, other than that every being needs and deserves it, and your heart is able to share it with them all. So maybe now you've seen the arising and the ending of the dukkha of ill will. Did everybody have a grudge that they could use? Oh, yes. Keep doing this, and you'll come to see Bhikkhu Bodhi's prescription work. It took me a while. I thought I was just doing an exercise because somebody I thought was wise told me to do it. And then one night, it was a dark night, no moon, I was on the freeway and someone almost ran right into me, hadn't looked, you know, changing lanes. Fortunately, I was paying attention, hit the brake. And there was a split second when I started thinking all sorts of nasty things about that person. And I just decided, no, I'm going to be very glad that at least one of us was paying attention. And the two of us didn't have to go through the unpleasantness of a crash. It paid off. The practice works. And eventually, you might see deeper causes of ill will with the kind of insight that is truly liberating. And these are the two main paths to liberation: gradual observation of dukkha and insight into root causes. For this second path, retreats are invaluable. Ill will hides like nasty little bugs in tight crevices of our minds. Without noticing, we create cliff notes about people. I love that. Cliff notes. We do it. We do that with everyone. They're like summaries that we refer to instead of seeing the person and the moment-to-moment experience of their presence. And some of those notes, inevitably, are about things we don't like. So it leaves us with a tinge of negative feeling that makes us less trusting, less willing to support them. We all do it. We should realize it, though, acknowledge it, observe it, and look for any ways that we lean toward ill will because of it. Not because we're bad people for doing it and we need to be scolded. We suffer enough, really. We don't have to add a bunch of more arrows to it. It happens. We suffer. That's the first noble truth. So what we do in order to liberate ourselves is watch it. It is to be understood. In a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called Dividing One's Thinking into Two Sorts, Buddha said that before his awakening, when he was a mere bodhisattva, this was the way he practiced. He would bring up thoughts associated with different forms of dukkha. And he said, as I remained heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with ill will arose in me, just as it did in many of you a few minutes ago. Buddha said, I discerned that thinking imbued with ill will has arisen in me, and that leads to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding or liberation. He goes on, as I noticed that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. Whenever thinking imbued with ill will had arisen, I simply abandoned it, destroyed it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. I'm grinning because I think of this as the frontal attack approach, and it is a very valuable practice. I mean, it seems like a whole lot of aversion in it, and it's, you know, it's kind of a macho approach, but it works, it helps. When we develop the habit of saying, I see you, to this arising of ill will, it will subside. It's like surgery or antibiotics that remove something harmful from the body. It will frontally attack and wipe out that nasty bug of ill will. And there is another way. Maybe a kinder, gentler, softer, easier way. But both ways are important. And both involve looking deeply at our suffering, really experiencing it, and observing how it arises. Now, this really experiencing it, I can remember the first time I ever taught Dharma. My good friends and neighbors were my guinea pigs. And they were from Colombia, and they were fun-loving people. And I was trying to say, observe the suffering. And we were like halfway through this course that I'd set up for them, and they're going, what? That's not what I signed on for. I wanted life to get better. And you're telling me I should focus on the suffering. Yes, that's what it means to understand the First Noble Truth. See that it's there and how it works. Then, after observing the arising of dukkha around ill will, method number one is the frontal attack. And we just force our thoughts away from ill will. And method number two is turn the thoughts from ill will toward the four divine abodes. Now, I've said several times, both methods are important. And if I hadn't practiced that first one that night on the freeway, I wouldn't have had that practiced response of, no, I don't want to go there. But I had also practiced with the four divine abodes, with metta, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And so I was able to use both of these methods, you know, one right after the other, and end up feeling good about the fact that neither of us was in a collision. Metta is mentioned in the suttas most often as where we should turn our attention. But those other three divine abodes are very powerful too. So whatever works for you. If you like to take joy in the other person's happiness, go for it. Or if equanimity, you know, works for you, or compassion, just use it. The Venerable Pietissa Terra, in his talk on the elimination of anger, said what we've all heard before, but he said it well. When we feel angry with any person, we should try to find out some good in him, either in his way of thinking, or in his way of speaking, or in his way of acting. If we find some redeeming quality in him, we should ponder its value and ignore his bad qualities as natural weaknesses that are to be found in everyone. Whilst we think thus, our mind will soften, and we may even feel kindly toward that person. If we develop this way of thinking, we will be able to curb or eliminate our anger towards him. And the Venerable Monk gave this quote, this example. He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me of my property. The monk went on to say, whoever harbors such thoughts will never be able to still their enmity. And that's, you know, back to that woman who took refuge in anger. It just perpetuates the suffering. It's understandable, but it wasn't doing her any good. Probably my favorite quote from all of Buddhist literature comes from the Dhammapada. Never is ill will banished by ill will. It can only be stopped by goodwill. This is an eternal and immutable law. You may notice that so far I have not really touched on hatred. You probably remember greed, hatred, and delusion are the causes of suffering. Well, we like to think that we don't have any hatred. And for the people in this room, it may be true. That intensity of ill will. Hatred, to me, feels like something caught in my throat that interferes with my ability to live. It's a very unpleasant feeling. And recently, in a group discussion about ill will, several people pointed out that we can but shouldn't suppress such feelings, because that's ultimately counterproductive. To just push away, submerge feelings that will sit inside us and fester without giving them attention. But during this discussion, I said, but don't indulge them. Don't indulge the feelings or even the thoughts. Like the monk quoted, the thoughts of he abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, blah, blah, blah. That's the story. Get out of the story as soon as you can. But what I was forgetting in that moment, in that conversation, was that when we're in the throes of white-hot anger or hatred, it's hard to draw the line. It's hard to remember. It's like we're in a fever and we can only take our medicine in little sips. We can't just turn the page completely. But it's good to start practicing as soon as we possibly can, in little sips. So I do have an example of hatred, or something very close to it, in my life now. And that's politics. For decades, I have said that I vote against the opposition rather than for my own party. And it may be more true this year than ever before, but in every election, I feel this way. And it doesn't feel good. I sip on my medicine every day when I read the newspaper during this painful election process. You know, long before the primaries started, I knew how I was going to vote. You know, I haven't been educated during this process. And it doesn't do me or anybody else any good, particularly here in California, to be harping on how awful that person is. That's like taking poison and expecting him to die. I will participate in this democracy the best I can. And meanwhile, I will practice in every way I can, which means I will avoid the temptation to slip into ill will whenever I can. There's another insight that came out of that group discussion I mentioned a while ago. It was that ill will is one of the many faces of aversion. It's one of the two demons, you know, hatred and greed, that are spawned by our ignorance of our true nature. That we are just embodied awareness, and without really grasping that, we're clinging to some idea of self. Several people in this group discussion noted that any aversion can lead to other forms of aversion. And so someone acts in a way that maybe causes another event to arise, and this is an event toward which I feel aversion, and voila, I have aversion to this person who could no more on their own have rearranged reality. It just was, you know, part of what was going on. Now, maybe they were motivated by ill will. They really meant to cause me suffering. But you know what really caused my suffering? My ignorance of karma, of how things work in the world. That this is a kaleidoscope, and there are all these little bits and pieces and fragments of causation that are tumbling around, and moment by moment form different pictures. And maybe I like one, and maybe I don't like another, but it's my dislike of the moment's picture that causes my suffering. What that person did really didn't have that strong a cause, and even if they were acting from ill will, that's their suffering, not mine. Aversion takes the form of fear, regret, ill will, and any kind of resistance to the truth of what is in the moment. Yeah, we can act to change things, and we can probably do that most efficiently if we're not under the influence of aversion as we do it. If we can act to improve what we perceive to be a bad situation out of metta, out of love for all beings, our ability to act in an effective way will be much greater than if we're acting from the suffering of aversion. Now, the practices that I've discussed can reduce the aversion that we feel, and whatever other forms of dukkha that it causes. Today, I've been focusing on ill will because it's in direct opposition to love. Looking at ill will is a good way to see how metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity bring a balm to our suffering, any form of suffering, but particularly ill will. And we can easily see the great value of living with goodwill. What the suttas call over and over non-harming. It's certainly better than living with our negative attitudes, our grudges, or even hatred. In closing, I'm going to read a poem by Mary Oliver from her collection, Dreamwork. I'm sure you all know by now, I love Mary Oliver. And I freely admit that I have read this poem many times, and I am still working with it, just as I continue to work with ill will. And so I will leave it to you to interpret her poem in light of this talk. The Visitor. My father, for example, who was young once and blue-eyed, returns on the darkest of nights to the porch and knocks wildly at the door. And if I answer, I must be prepared for his waxy face, for his lower lip swollen in bitterness. And so, for a long time, I did not answer, but slept fitfully between his hours of rapping. But finally there came the night when I rose out of my sheets and stumbled down the hall. The door fell open, and I knew I was saved and could bear him, pathetic and hollow, with even the least of his dreams frozen inside him, and the meanness gone. And I greeted him and asked him into the house and lit the lamp and looked into his blank eyes, in which at last I saw what a child must love. I saw what love might have done had we loved in time. Thank you.